Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage Podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum, and today we're talking about what it takes to command and control assets from the sky. Aircraft like the E-3 AWACS and the E-8 JSTARS have been fixtures on the forward edge of the battle space. And while their massively powerful radars give them a tremendous advantage over what's occurring in the sky and on the ground, turning raw data into actionable information comes down to the highly trained air battle managers on board in these aircraft. Now, normally we think about pilots as the lead actors in an aircraft, but in the case of these systems, the pilot's driving the aircraft and the air battle manager is managing the assets in and around the fight. And the reason why this matters is really simple. In combat, the person who has a decision advantage will generally prevail. It's all about understanding how to maximize a relative position to best achieve the mission while avoiding or minimizing threats. It doesn't matter whether you're on the ground or in the air, information is life. You want proof? Look at the Battle of Britain. In the summer of 1940, the Royal Air Force had 446 operational fighters to face 3,500 German combat aircraft across the channel. Between August 8th and August 18th of 1940, the RAF lost 154 pilots and only got 63 green replacements. Their defensive force was under tremendous strain. Effective command and control, what we now call C2, thanks to their radar network, their control system, and the radio connectivity to their fighters, is what allowed them to prevail. It was all about directing available fighters to precise intercepts and ensuring any effort was aimed at a desired outcome. What AWACS and JSTARS did was to take this sort of capability to the sky so that it could deploy to the edge of the battle space anytime, anywhere. But we've also had these jets for decades, and a lot has changed regarding the technology, the threat environment, and mission demands. Plus, these systems are built on 707 airframes. Those jets are getting really old. So the Air Force is considering a range of options to ensure C2 capabilities can be delivered, but in a way that will better meet the demand and harness the strengths afforded by modern technology. And I'll tell you right up front, the thesis of our show today is really simple. The way tactical C2 is delivered is going to change, but the human battle managers will still remain central to the process. Their judgment is crucial to make sense of things in the chaos of combat. So to kick things off here, I'd like to set the stage from an operational perspective with Mitchell Institute Dean, Lieutenant General retired David Deptula. Sir, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, Lick. It's great to be on again.
Well, sir, as we know from our past episodes talking about Desert Storm, you all saw the first employment of the E-8 JSTARS in combat. And as I understand it, the JSTARS battle managers really saved the day in such a critical time of the conflict. So can you walk us through that?
Slick, you bet. But before I do that, I want to provide some clarity regarding the aircraft and a bit of background. Coming out of Vietnam, it was clear that air crews needed a quarterback to better understand what was occurring in the battle space real time. Tracking the threats and the friendlies was extremely challenging. Picture getting bombarded by multiple sensor feeds inside your fighter cockpit, the radio constantly filled with voices, trying to track what was going on in your given flight, thinking about the mission objectives, how to accomplish them, and trying to anticipate hostile enemy activity. In reality, it was overwhelming to even the most experienced pilots. Now, we had some basic command and control or C2 systems over there, but we needed a far more capable solution. So based on the experiences of Vietnam, those C2 challenges were in part managed by the Airborne Warning and Control System, or AWACS, a Boeing 707 with a huge radar mounted on top of it, and a crew of air battle managers inside. They focused on making sense of what was going on in the air-to-air realm. Now, the jet came out in the late 1970s, and it was a huge game changer. As a matter of fact, as a brand new F-15 pilot, I actually flew in one of the AWACS's first large-scale operational tests back in 1978. Think about it this way. It's sort of like having a GPS in your car helping you navigate instead of juggling a map in rush hour traffic.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it didn't take long before folks thought about radar focused on the ground. Could we gain similar situational awareness so that we could understand the position of the enemy forces, avoid threats, and better see how to strike targets on the battle space with concentrated mass? Think about the Battle of Britain example, using battle space knowledge to put your forces at the right time in the right place to get the job done. And remember, our focus was against the Soviet Union in the 1980s. We were stretched very thin, so we had to use our aircraft as smartly as possible. The system that came out of that requirement was the E-8 Joint Surveillance and Target Attack Radar System, or better known as JSTARS. It came out right as the Cold War was drawing to a close, but it's been flown hard in every conflict since.
Got it.
So the first time we sent it to war was Desert Storm. And even though it was still in test and evaluation, and it hadn't officially been approved for operational use, the combatant commander really wanted to apply it. And it's good we pushed for it because it proved critical during a key phase of the war. While we're all busy with the air campaign, Saddam Hussein was doing everything he could to pull our attention off the offensive, shooting missiles into Israel and Saudi Arabia, weapons of mass destruction threats, and more. Now, as part of his response to our air campaign, he launched a ground attack on the night of the 29th of January across the Kuwait border into a Saudi Arabian town known as Kafji. He thought he could use the cover of darkness to hide his attack, and it was a surprise. But thanks to the JSTARS, the cover of darkness did not help him at all, as we were able to rapidly understand exactly what was happening. JSTARS, along with other systems impervious to darkness, took away the night from yielding any attack advantage. The battle managers on board the jet could literally see the Iraqi forces, their individual tanks and armored vehicles. It was absolutely incredible, and I would call it a watershed moment in the history of warfare and part of the change in the character of warfare that the air campaign introduced during Desert Storm. And using this information, we could do two things. First, we could rapidly determine that limited forces were involved on Saddam's part, certainly not enough for a major invasion of Saudi Arabia. And second, we could mount a focused response to destroy the majority of attacking forces and then eject those remaining from Saudi Arabia because we understood exactly their position in the surrounding context. At the strategic coalition level, resecuring Saudi Arabia was hugely important. If we didn't have that sort of insight that JSTARS provided, we would have had been forced to divert a significant number of assets away from the principal offensive taking the fight to Saddam inside Iraq. That's what Saddam Hussein wanted us to do. But information and effective tactical command and control kept the coalition focused on the real mission at hand.
Yeah, it's absolutely an incredible story. And what's even more impressive, thinking back, is, you know, JSTARS was still a test article at that time. And the crew had minimal operational experience, obviously, and they were inventing their tactics, techniques, and procedures real time because it was all brand new.
Yeah, Slick, that's right. And a shout out to the gentleman at the time, Colonel George Molnar, was the head of the JSTARS detachment. George later became a three-star general, responsible for setting up the initial concepts regarding F-35. And then he also became the chairman of the Air Force Association and unfortunately passed away at a relatively early age last year. But you know, this is why when we talk about airborne sensors, command and control, and the people who all make it possible, it's extraordinarily important, and I'm a believer. But also think about the mission this way. The jets, the mission systems, and the crew concepts were all developed before the World Wide Web went public. A ton has changed when it comes to gathering data, processing it into information, and then sharing the insights. And so defense leaders have been asking a lot of questions regarding how to better execute this mission in the future. And they're right to do so. A heck of a lot has changed since the Cold War. We need smartphone-like solutions, not a landline bolted to the wall. So charting the next steps in this process involves understanding what needs to change, where technology can help us, how to guard against vulnerabilities, and where human cognition adds strength. And remember that this mission needs to succeed at the very same time our adversaries are seeking to defeat it, whether that's trying to shoot down a mission aircraft, jamming our data links, or injecting uncertainty or deception into our decision calculus. So this isn't as simple as setting up a network and just assuming it's going to work. This is command and control under fire in the information age. And it's a tough challenge. Just look at the problems we're having as a nation with ransomware attacks and network security. Multiply that threat 1,000 times and you get the picture of how challenging this is in combat. We are talking varsity level challenges, and the solutions we put forward need to account for that. That's a key reason why we need to balance smart improvements with technical adventurism that may inject more risk than solutions.
Well, sir, I couldn't agree more. And with the ransomware example that you mentioned, really hits it home because, you know, we as a nation take connectivity for granted because it just seems to work all the time. And when it doesn't work, that's when we realize we're really in a bad spot. And I think we've grown complacent on the military side of the equation because we've had such technical network dominance operating over Iraq and Afghanistan for a few decades. And obviously things are gonna get a lot harder against an advanced opponent. So they've been watching us for years, they know the vulnerability, and it's really important that we evolve.
Well, you know what, Slick, that's spot on. And I look forward to hearing what some of the other folks have to say about this topic.
Thanks again for being here, sir.
You bet.
So with that, I'd like to welcome Major Alex Big Bobby Wallace to the show. Bobby is an air battle manager who has both time in the AWACS and the JSTARS. He's also a weapons school graduate from the C2 division. And he has spent the past year with us at the Mitchell Institute as an Air Force fellow researching command and control. So Bobby, welcome.
Hey, Slick. Thanks. Glad to be here. Happy to talk about battle management, command and control, and all of the greatness we bring to the airspace.
Yeah, the main thing that we're talking about is, you know, you are the key guy on these planes, and General Deptula, we just had a session with him talking about it, and you're the quarterback. Walk us through the jets that you've flown and what would we see on a mission and who are the players and what sort of equipment do we see and how would the JSTARS look different than an AWACS from an air battle manager's view?
Yeah, so, you know, first off, I had to talk about what the theater air control system is, really what the E3 AWACS, the E8 JSTARS, and then, you know, the ground base, the GTACs, the CRC also fit into this as well, in the similar echelon of battle management, command and control in our system. So, you know, talking about just the airborne platforms, they're both based off of 707, so four engines, single aisle aircraft. And when you walk on the airplane, they actually look a little more similar than they do different from an operator console point of view. There are some differences in the sense that the screen's a little bit larger on a JSTARS. But the Block 30, the Block 40 upgrade to the E3 really kind of brought a lot of modern computing to it. So they look a little bit more similar now than they did before. Aside from the exterior difference where you look at a JSTARS, you've got the radar on the bottom. AWACS has the radar on the top. The E3 also has a passive system that JSTARS doesn't have. So, you know, from a sensor suite standpoint, they're complementary and they don't have very many redundant features between them. So from a comm system standpoint, they actually are pretty similar. They both bring in UHF, VHF communication capabilities. They have an HF capability. They have they also have link capabilities. The JSTARS has a little bit more link capability with some of our Army brethren, considering it is the joint STARS and was originally developed to support both services and still does support both services. So, and from that, operators on both the E3, the E8, and in the CRC as well has its own complement. I'll be remiss to forget them in the tacks. I'd hear about it, be unrelenting. But, you know, all those operators have the ability to tap into the different communication methods from their console, as well as the internal networks that we use to talk between each other. So the crew composition looks pretty similar between them, minus a few technicians that operate on different comm equipment or different radar equipment, but both have surveillance teams. So think about that, where the sensor data is analyzed and tracks are developed. Then we have link data put on it. It's verified by a senior track manager on both aircraft. And then it starts to go over now to the weapons section, station is what we call it. So that's your entry level controllers. That's where we all start off. And they will, they work for a senior director who works for the mission crew commander. And they've just recently changed these terms up as we've gone over to a more holistic air battle manager qualification in our career field. So, but this is kind of the way that the hierarchy works right now. That mission crew commander also is in charge of the technicians on board the aircraft that manage the comms systems and the radar systems. So if things break in flight, we can go down and manipulate it. And those technicians are also there evaluating the system interference and make recommendations on if we need to start taking some maneuvers, if you will, in the electromagnetic spectrum to remain combat viable. And then, of course, on the airborne platforms, we've got a pilot in command, so our AC, our co-pilot, and a navigator. And then the CRC does not have that component, but it looks pretty similar in the back end from a crew perspective. And, you know, in the tent now for the CRC. But otherwise, that's pretty much what they do. And so they're both highly in demand. The E3 and the E8 are in demand, deployed around the world as we speak. The sun is not setting on the 461st Air Control Wing or the 552 Air Control Wing. We've got CRCs that are all over the world as well that are providing support in air defense squadrons. And then, they're doing mission supporting command and control, battle management, ISR missions, as well as counter drug and homeland defense.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. And as you and I have talked and I've shared with you, you know, I had the opportunity being the fighter to JSTARS liaison. It was a new position that we established when we were in LUD and dating myself back in 2004. But I had an opportunity to fly an 11.6-hour mission on the mighty JSTARS. And it is really incredible to see the teamwork that happens on the back end. And I don't think a lot of folks, especially those flying pointy nose airplanes, understand what goes on back there. So I appreciate you bringing that to us. And I really want to dive into, from a tactical perspective, the actual facets of what it is that you do. Because like I mentioned, for so long, people are kind of lumped into this acronym of C2ISR. That's how the aircraft function. They have the massive onboard sensors that you mentioned, and they gather the data, and then there's a command and control team that might do something with that raw data to make it into something actionable. And it probably has created a lot of misconceptions regarding how this needs to exist in the future. So, C2ISR doesn't need to be the static entity. There's a lot more nuance to it. I'm sure you're going to enlighten us here.
Yeah, so I mean, you're exactly right. A lot of people don't understand the battle management that goes on these platforms as well, and the capabilities. So a lot of people do C2. You know, we hear C2 thrown around in a lot of different subject areas. I mean, there's nuclear C2, there's all kinds of command and control. But you know what we do is command and control battle management in for the air assets. And so, you know, we'll start off with some basic elements of what I'm calling, and this is a big part of my research here, is the C2 Trinity. And what that is comprised of is a sensor element, action elements, and a decision element. And so these aircraft are often overlooked as critical decision elements, scalable decision elements that can go into a battle space and provide a bridge from the pointy nose folks to the operational AOR or the operational air operations center. And we just saw an example of that this past week in the Armed Service, the House Armed Service Committee's testimony from the Air Force, where the JSTARS was referred to purely as a GMTI sensor, and that it was looked at in that sense, and it was going to be replaced by another array that we'll talk about a little bit later. And there was really not any acknowledgement of where's this battle management function now going to occur and the flexible, scalable options that it provides. So if you think about it, ISR has the goal to answer questions that commanders issue, so the commander's critical intelligence requirements, and those are put out usually by combatant commanders and other elements of the strategic and operational decision makers, and they're going to answer those questions through different processes. The one that I've read the most about is Processing Exploitation Dissemination, or PED. There's also, I think, a couple of others out there like PC PAD, but they all generally mean the same thing. Take in data, generate something actionable to answer these questions. And that kind of works in a different time scale than what C2 battle managers work in. So, you know, if you think about, they're going to look at mountains of data. They're going to try to analyze this over a period of hours or days or months, depending on what the question is, where what I'm going to do on the back end of that aircraft is look at that data and how do I execute that as a target, pass that off to somebody that could take action again within minutes. Slick, you flew F-16s. What's your loiter time out there when you're waiting on targets to be passed?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it could be long or short, but typically not as robust as obviously your airplane. So.
But it's the, you need that data in a much quicker period of time, and you need that analysis to occur really fast. And so that's really what, that's what we specialize in doing. So not only am I, you know, not only do I have a crew that's analyzing this information, that's providing something to go and take action against, and it's not perfect, right? There's some errors in there. I think we've talked about some targets you've been vectored against in the past that aren't necessarily, you know, tanks, but, you know, at the end of the day, we're also balancing that with airspace control requirements or resources like fuel. You know, who do we have coming behind that has weapons to put against potential targets? And we're balancing this data analysis and resource and risk management on behalf of the combatant commanders all at the same time from this node. And that just is overlooked. It's overlooked a lot. And there's not very many battle managers. Actually, it was pointed out to me yesterday that there's more Navy SEALs than there are air battle managers in the DoD. So just kind of let that sink in for a minute about when he talks about mission understanding. So while
we're just going to have to get a really good movie about air battle management, it's going to fix the whole thing. So
yeah, unfortunately the depictions of the AWACS and like Independence Day didn't go so well, but Transformers, we looked pretty good. You know, so if you look at like what ISR's time scale and what they're trying to do, it's a little bit different. Although we complement each other, we can use each other's data for sure. It should be mutually supporting. The objectives are different, and it does require kind of two different levels of expertise.
Sure. And, you know, one of the things you and I have talked about this before, I think the average person flying in a normal, you know, CAF fighter squadron doesn't really get an opportunity to integrate very often with an AWACS or a JSTARS. And I know at the weapons school, it's all about the integration. So I know that I'm spoiled in the sense that I got to work alongside many folks from the barnyard doing many different missions. And one thing that if the voice of any of the controllers ever said, you know, Slick, target this person over here, I would absolutely do it, knowing the, you know, kind of global SA that that they're, you all see on a, you know, following your mission. So it's absolutely critical. You guys are part of the kill chain and, you know, absolutely directing fires as you see fit to do so. So just to make that clear for anybody listening that doesn't really understand how the integration between in my case, fighter pods are with you all as a controller. So I want to hear from you though on this, because you've spent a lot of time flying combat missions over the last few years. And I'd like you to walk us through some of your observations regarding the current state of play and the recent lessons learned that you've had when it comes to warfare and information.
Yeah, so to kind of get after what you're talking about, you know, we'll do a target direction, but we're also looking the next one beyond that, which it frees you up now to prosecute what's in front of you, knowing that there's somebody back there looking after the follow-on target and thinking about like your fuel state. And so that's really a big piece of what we do. You know, like once you get inside the merge, that's for you, buddy. Like go and get it. And we're going to start worrying about what's the next thing down the pipe and getting you some gas and other support or calling in other resources. And that's really a big part of that integration, because, you know, I think a big mistake that happens is we go to red flags, we go to other exercises, and it's a 2 to 3 hour vol. You know, war is going to be much longer than 2 or 3 hours. You know, we're going to have to worry about the follow-on intercepts. You know, I sit on station for 8 or more hours at a time. You know, like we were going to deal with several waves of this and manage several waves of it at that operational tactical bridging level. And so that's a big piece of what we've done. Now, we talk about what's changed in the battle space from the time that these aircraft and systems were developed. And one of that is just this ton of information that is starting to be pumped into the AOR and has become available. And so if you look at, you know, we hear different statistics, but it's like on the order of like thousands of percent increases of data available or data that's out there that has to be processed now. And so that's huge. That's a massive piece. So it's not just our sensors anymore that are pumping into it. It's a lot of others that we can make decisions off of. And so, you know, we start talking a little bit about artificial intelligence, AI, and where it fits in. And this is definitely a place where it can help us a lot. So, you know, over the last 20 years, it's really gone this direction. So I've spent a lot of time flying in combat and specializing in the fusion of sensor data to drive targeting in the short term. So ideally from discovery to action inside of a few minutes, like we talked about. When I was an electronic combat officer on the AWACS, I experienced firsthand how this flood of data now, particularly in the electromagnetic spectrum, can really start to overwhelm the systems and tactics that are in place. And we're going to need some help with that in the future. On JSTARS, I experienced a very similar effect now supporting dynamic targeting. So we talk about what goes into dynamic targeting. It's a function of risk, but generally what we're trying to do is take a track, fuse some information with it, get it to be something actionable, and then we're going to make sure we have the resources, the airspace control to go in and take action against it. We've got a lot more information that's available, and we're going to need something to help us filter it. So, over the past few decades, we've been working in sensor-flooded, permissive environments that have given us the ability to pipe it back, think about it, and to kind of take action at our leisure. However, there's going to be many cases in the future where this is luxury is just simply not going to be available. And if you look at what our adversaries have done, they have studied how our way of war, and they're looking at ways to cause interference in it. So I'll give you one example. Look at Odyssey Dawn. It happened in the early 2010s. It was a scalable response that the E3 and the E8 provided. It basically, drop of the hat, over the course of hours, they were able to get inside of an AOR and put not just sensors, but crews in place to start managing the elements of this fight and achieving our national objectives. So it took both, by the way. It took both the E3 and the E8 to get these things in place. And I'd like to point out that the E8 was originally only fragged out as a sensor, but ended up filling so many other C2 type roles in concert with the E3 to make sure that we were prosecuting this in the timeliness that we wanted. And so this was not that long ago, Slick. I mean, this was just less than 10 years that we saw this example, and we were called upon to provide quick action.
Right. So with that being said, where does this leave us today with the current C2 and ISR system?
Well, Slick, these jets are aging, from a C2 battle management standpoint. Like, we're working off of older platforms. We've watched our allies upgrade to different things, and we've kind of stayed on the same plane. And it's not just the airframe. Like, these sensors can support the integration of distributed sensors, distributed comm. Like, software has really come a long way. The ISR community is kind of illustrating that with their space-based and unmanned systems that can start piping in. Like, command and control battle management could take advantage of that same type of construct. Right. So I often hear about these planes being legacy. And I would agree with that if we continue to constrain our employment and our thought about employment in a legacy manner. And so we need to remember what they provide: rapid, scalable decision sensor and comm nodes that could be anywhere in a total package within hours. So as an operator on these platforms, I want to see an expansion of the use of manned airborne C2 assets that take advantage of these disaggregated sensors and disaggregated communication networks. And basically, it's going to give our combatant commanders and our more flexible options to provide effects.
Sure. Well, I've got to ask you this then. How does fifth gen fit into this picture? With the F-35 and F-22 having the huge array of information that they have, which, totally blows away what I ever had in the F-16. How does this fit into the mix?
Wow. Fifth gen's pretty awesome. And I've had the opportunity to work with fifth gen, both in my undergraduate air battle management training at Tyndall. I got to work with them when I was going through the weapons school in 2015, and we integrated pretty closely with them. And what they have available from an information perspective is truly impressive. However, when you look at it, if it's only staying on that airplane, that pilot still has to fight and survive in a hostile environment and keep themselves safe. And if that information is only there and it's not going to other places to allow us to do that follow-on and quarterbacking, then we start to run into a few problems. And so along the lines of expanding what we are considering the legacy employment, it'd be great to devise ways to pipe this type of sensor data to the quarterbacks. So that help better basically get the resources allocation out there, manage the fight and the decisions that need to be made. So in a way, it's bringing third generation C2 up to fifth generation information standards. So when you combine that fifth generation data with tactical data from ISR systems, you stand to be at the very edge of scaled combat information dominance.
Yeah, that all makes absolute sense. And one of the things I want to ask you about was Mitchell's paper that we released on C2 and ISR recently, and emphasized the notion of tiering the C2 experts throughout the battle space. What's the idea behind that?
Well, Slick, you've been in exercises. How much fog is just inserted in the mere app, just the start of fighting, right? So we have to expect that this fog and uncertainty is going to be in any type of future conflict and warfare. So having that appropriately scaled command element at the edge of the battle space is going to give combatant commanders options to cut that fog. You know, when you think about where we're at, you know, when communications get jammed, when things get interrupted, our C2 systems now, as legacy as they are, they still have a lot of tools at their disposal to work around these types of interruptions. We know that the adversary is trying to find more ways to get into this. But one thing that can't be beat is that we're within a degree of line of sight of these things. We can maneuver ourselves to reestablish these communications in very quick time when it starts to get interrupted. And so I've seen this many times where we've had to shift where we go and move ourselves to provide enhanced sensor and enhanced communications or balance trade-offs between the two. Like maybe I go over here, it's not as good as sensor coverage, or maybe there's no sensor coverage, but I'm providing a comm link now and I'm using a disaggregated sensor to get the effect into the battle space. And being at the edge on a manned and maneuverable platform makes that possible and it gives you options.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you guys are so agile in the airspace to do all the things that you mentioned, and line of sight is obviously critical. Now, we've talked about, and you mentioned it earlier, the role of artificial intelligence and how that's going to play in the C2 realm. Obviously, you know, we know that there's a huge amount of data that's coming in, you know, that's being processed. And I'd like to understand where you think this is going to happen in the C2 system. And in my mind just goes to like our air battle managers eventually going to be replaced by an R2-D2 type.
Yeah, I know you're alluding to the quote from Mr. Roper about R2-D2, but I would like to remind everybody that R2-D2 still had a pilot. There was still somebody in the cockpit. And so, you know, AI is certainly going to play a role in the future, and it should. As we mentioned, like that data filtering, the needles in the haystack, putting things together, providing options to the decision makers. But it's going to go off of known parameters that can and we should expect them to be deceived. I mean, we can't expect to field something that the adversary is not going to look for a way to upend. So let's look at something as predictable as the subway system. You know, we see a subway system and it goes up and down a track that's very fixed on a timeline that is published that it should be adhering to. However, there's still a pilot in the front of that thing, and there's still an operations center that has people in it that are out there to work around these anomalies and respond to these anomalies and provide, well, a type of management, you know, a command and control function. Here's another example. Let's look at something as predictable as air travel. You know, air travel is going from point A to point B with a lot of different things that happen along the way, but there's still a pilot, there's still ground control, there's still departure, they're still en route. And this is on a very predictable thing where our biggest adversary is usually the weather that can stand to upset this. But we still have people that are at every function of this, providing that command and control and responding to changes in the environment. Now, let's imagine what's going to happen in combat when you have something actively trying to interrupt this and provide confusion, and confusion in the most insidious ways. I mean, we have it put artificial intelligence in our air travel system. Why would we look at just inserting it now into something as complex as combat?
Sure. Yeah. I couldn't agree more. And that, you know, that's always my, my counter argument to, drone quote unquote airplanes without anybody. And it's like, well, whenever we put our entire, you know, our grandparents and our kids on a plane that doesn't have a pilot, you know, that'll be the day that, that I know I'm out of a job. So, but, now I do want to talk about, we've heard a lot about the air battle management system and the joint all domain command and control, or ABMS and JADC2. We've talked about it on the podcast quite a bit, playing a big role on the mission. So what's the deal?
So I guess it kind of depends on which definition of JADC2 and ABMS we're working off of in this time frame. But, you know, generally speaking, I've heard it and I've seen it explained, and I really think that it is a concept that's going to be a huge help to the command and control battle management construct. But it's not a battle manager, it's not a sensor, and it is not an action element. Rather, what it is, it's a far better linkage between those elements. It's gonna help with a lot of efficiency, take advantage of all the information and resources that are in the battle space. And we desperately need to improve it, but it can't be at the expense of nodes that we still need throughout the battle space. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not advocating that we not sunset legacy systems and pursue other things. I absolutely think that we have to work that direction. But we can't sunset these things without a functional replacement for the nodes that they are providing. I mean, with that, you're just kind of injecting a disadvantage or a weakness into our system and our ability to respond to threats around the world.
Yeah. So I know you've studied this a lot, so I'm not asking you to shoot off the hip or look into your crystal ball, but 10 years from now, how do you think this mission is going to play out, and what does that vision look like?
Yeah, so like you mentioned, I'm kind of hesitant, you know, to predict because I'm not a futurist. But what I'll say is I'm hoping that we continue to work. You know, I'm hoping that I'm going to study this, and as I return back to operations, think about it a little bit more. But here's what I can say. The threats are growing, and they are more advanced than they ever were before. And we're going to have to find creative ways to maintain advantage, and that's going to mean thinking and employing differently. So call it sixth generation C2 thinking. And in this manner, we will need flexible and rapid employment options of getting command elements survivably into the battle space with as few induced weaknesses as possible. So our system is going to need the elemental maneuverability and scalability to respond not only to our most peer-related threats, but also the kind of conflicts that popped up the last time we saw great peer competition taking place, and that was during the Cold War. So while we were preparing to fight with Russia and Europe, what we were actually fighting was proxy wars in Vietnam and Korea, and those conditions were very different. And we learned painful lessons employing with the same tactics as we did that we were planning on using against Russia. The cost of these mistakes is going to be far greater with an adversary such as China out there.
Right. One of the things I want to ask you about while we have a few minutes left is looking at the headlines, it looks like JSTAR is looked at as a mission that could be migrated to space. So I'd like you to talk about how you see that potentially working out, and what are the key factors that we would need to consider, what it would actually be like to do the commanding and controlling from space-based assets, the ability to provide consistent coverage in a flexible fashion, or ensuring that the data links can even keep up. I mean, those are just some of the things that come to mind. So what are the key questions that you'd ask?
You know, as we talked about before, battle managers, they work in minutes, you know, on JSTARS. We work in minutes to take advantage of that data, provide clear airspace, ensure strike aircraft are resourced. And that's all really before we even pass something into your cockpit that you've got to start responding to. So in that sense, the questions that I have are, you know, I want to know if these critical tasks are covered in this function when it moves into the space-based suite. Is that information being forwarded to the appropriate tax agency that can utilize it in the same fashion that a JSTARS does? Is that agency flexible and scalable to that battle space? You know, can it provide the same type of coverage as quickly? How does this, let's take the construct as it's been pitched. How would that fit into an Odyssey Dawn example? Like if we rewind, you know, however many years now, and we just apply that model, what would the cost of that be? How would that work? And I think, you know, if we could start answering some of those questions, will it work in the same time constraint? You know, can these satellites flex to the coverage, and what kind of resources is that going to take? You know, what kind of fuel is that going to take? How many times can they do that thing? And so I think there's a ton of goodness in it. I think that we just have to understand what the other functions are that are being replaced, and how are we going to get that information into these other functions with the same flexibility, with the same redundancy, and the same combatant commander options that are out there. More than just the intelligence portion of it, more than just the sensor data. You know, it's the other parts that are provided.
Right. Well, Bobby, we're unfortunately out of time. I know you and I can definitely chat for hours on flying stories and paving the future for C2s. But I just wanted to use this opportunity to say thanks. It's been really great working with you over the last year at Mitchell. What you've brought regarding C2 has been tremendously important, and couldn't have come at a better time. So from all of us at Mitchell, thank you so much, and good luck at SAS.
Well, I appreciate it too. And thanks to Mitchell for providing the area for me to take advantage of it and the resources to have the conversation. So I look forward to working with you guys again.
With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning into today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn. And you can always find us at MitchellAerospacePower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.